Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer and a long ago former colleague of mine, Chris Mitchell. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
And this is a bit of a sad show because we are recording just a few days after the death of David Bowie, which obviously has affected many, many people around the world because he was such a great artist and was so prolific and so long-lived as an artist. But we specifically, and we will talk about Bowie in general, I'm sure, but we specifically come here today to talk about his Tin Machine venture, which is something that a lot of people, I mean, I'm sure a lot of Bowie fans may not even realise is a thing. And those who do probably are only aware that, oh, it was a weird thing that he did that nobody liked. So as I know you are a long, long time Bowie fan and even a, you know, bigger, way bigger fan than me even. I'm looking forward to talking to you about this.
Yes, it is. Truly one of the great items in culture that is unjustly maligned, the whole Tin Machine project. In fact, there were two albums and a live album, which is probably best forgotten about. But it's so unjustly maligned that the second album has been deleted. You can't get it on iTunes. The only place you can find it is on YouTube or secondhand on Amazon as an actual CD. It's very 20th century.
Wow, yeah, deleting CDs, that's something that sort of almost doesn't happen anymore because, you know, so few bands even bother putting out CDs now.
That's right. I mean, on Amazon, I was just looking today, it was a Japanese import that you could buy. But and the other thing that was it's very old and obviously making me feel my age and no doubt your age too, is all of the different formats, the vinyl album, the cassette and the CD all had different track listings on them. They put extra tracks only on the CD and all that. Yeah, this is the day when CD was so new that they still put extra tracks in it to entice you to buy it because it was more expensive than the record. So there's even three variants of the first Tin Machine album cover. If you remember, it's the four band members standing in very nice suits. But if you look at the album cover, the vinyl album cover, then the cassette, then the CD, it's actually three different photos.
They're all standing in different orders, aren't they?
That's right, exactly, yeah.
Which I always thought was probably part of the attempt to say this is a band, this is not David Bowie and his backing band, this is a band of which Bowie is a part.
Absolutely. Well, that was the whole reason for the band to exist, was for Bowie to effectively step away from being David Bowie, which obviously it just seems like a completely ludicrous idea, and he was vilified for it. But when you look in retrospect about why he did that, it does make complete sense. Tin Machine was released in 1989, so that's when I was 17 years old. And it came on the heels of the Never Let Me Down album, which was in 1987, which was a huge letdown. It was Bowie's creative meltdown. It was his self-confessed nadir. And even though he did a huge tour, Glass Spider tour, which I think went to like four different continents, and obviously I would assume made him a huge amount of money, the album as well, Never Let Me Down, was a huge bestseller. It went gold within 3 months of release. But it was dreadful. It was absolutely dreadful. He said in interviews like a few years later that he basically just didn't turn up for the making of the album. He'd sort of wander in, do a vocal and just wander out again. He had completely abdicated responsibility for it. Now, which is particularly weird, given by that point he was straight. You know, he wasn't doing drugs anymore. I don't think he was even barely drinking. He just frankly lost interest in the music. This is all after Let's Dance and the huge success of that as well. And he was living in Switzerland. And, you know, I don't think that's particularly good for anyone's creativity. He'd slid into, basically he'd made it. He'd finally made it. Because don't forget, for all the 70s albums, which are obviously the canon and classic and cannot be argued with as some of the most important contributions to music, they didn't actually make him very much money, particularly given that most of it was stolen by his manager and blah, 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 blah.
Or blown on drugs.
Or blown on drugs, yes. The blizzard of cocaine did not help. So post Scary Monsters, you know, he still, clearly he was not going to be homeless on the street, but he certainly had not got the money in his bank that he was hoping for. And Let's Dance was a reaction to that. I mean, he actually said to Nile Rodgers, "I want a hit," and he wrote Let's Dance. I mean, not many people can actually sit down and write a hit in a completely self-conscious way, and he did it. It's bonkers. Anyway, so,
well, if you're going to get any two people in the world of music who can do that, you know, David Bowie and Nile Rodgers is a pretty safe bet.
absolutely. So that then followed from Let's Dance was Tonight, which was another dreadful album, mainly cover versions. It was his one appalling attempt to go into reggae. Just best forget about that. Then Never Let Me Down, which is even worse. Thankfully, at this point, I was too young to have really taken any of this in. So, obviously, I was 17 when Tin Machine came out, and I was already very much aware of Bowie. I knew the classic records. And I don't think I was such a super fan at that point that Never Let Me Down was a disappointment. It was just kind of like, oh, it's a record I don't really like. So with Tin Machine, because I was 17 years old, that was actually my first point of contact with Bowie, as in, here I am going down to the record shop on the first day it's released, buying a David Bowie record. Now, I know we just talked about it's him trying to disappear into a band, but of course it was David Bowie. The thing is, though, is that the reason Tin Machine was so important to Bowie's artistic revival is that the guitarist, Reeves Gabrels, had essentially said to Bowie, look, you know, you've just burnt out on what you're doing. You're hating what you're doing. You need to just step back and start thinking about yourself and just do what you want to do. Because that's basically why you were great to begin with, because you were totally selfish and just followed your own weird ideas and passions. And in the 80s, you've sort of become David Bowie, you know, the megastar, the polite soul funk, all that kind of stuff. And it's just asinine. I'm not sure he used that word, but I think that's what he's trying to get to. And Bowie, God bless him, listen to him. I mean, there's lots of twists and turns in this. Obviously, Bowie must have a planet, or did have a planet-sized ego. But he has always been brilliant at recognizing collaborators. I mean,
yeah,
throughout all of this, yeah, so we don't need to go into that. So he's always been good at recognizing collaborators and the people that will push him. And obviously, on the one hand, Bowie has always had a very clear idea about what he wants to do. He works incredibly fast. And that's why musicians love working with him, because he has an idea and he says, bang, let's do it, let's move on. Because he gets bored very quickly. With Reeves Gabrels, there was that sense of just saying, just loosen up. And it was also a lot of, when you listen to the albums, there was a lot of first thought, best thought, like the old Kerouac idea.
Mm.
And it was like, stop thinking about it all the time, just do it. And I think because, again, Bowie got so caught up in the whole corporate pop structure. I mean, don't forget he was doing adverts for Pepsi and stuff by this point. I mean, it's not ridiculous. He can do whatever he wants, but certainly he'd sort of gone off the rails about why was he bothering to do this at all. So by that point, with Tin Machine, what you get is it's basically like, it's almost like Nirvana's In Utero. It's just this attempt to really, really annoy all of his new fans.
Success.
And he succeeded. Yes. Mission accomplished. And it's weird because, so that came in 1989. And when did Nevermind come out? Was that the following year? No,
it was 91, I think.
91. Okay. Right. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. But basically, when you go back and look at the critical reaction to Tin Machine, the first album essentially got largely a thumbs up in the UK press. I think Rolling Stone liked it as well. But yeah, there's a general sort of thumbs up for it. But of course, because it was Tin Machine and not David Bowie, it didn't sell at all. I mean, I think on Wikipedia it says it's now sold 2 million copies. So what, 25 years later? So that's probably one of the worst selling albums that Bowie's had any involvement.
Right,
with.
Yeah.
But when you listen to the tracks, the rawness of it, and particularly Reeves's guitar, which he did use like a weapon. And it is very, very, very redolent of Robert Fripp, who obviously is the key guitarist on Scary Monsters and Heroes. And also Adrian Belew, I can never pronounce his name properly. But yeah, so that very experimental, squawky, dissonant, I'm just going to hit this whammy bar 10 times, I don't care kind of playing. So all of that stuff actually became, when you listen to Bowie's later albums like Outside and Earthling, that was kind of a prototype. And it's no surprise that Reeves is involved with those albums as well.
Well, he even produced Earthling.
Did he?
Yes.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he was one of the producers on Earthling. Yeah.
So in that sense, it was, I mean, a lot of people would definitely not agree with this, but it was Bowie's rebirth. It was a necessary catalyst for him to go through. Now, even the most sort of enthusiastic Bowie fans will still sort of be a bit sniffy about Tin Machine. But I submit that if you take the two albums and basically throw away half the tracks, what you get left with is one absolutely fantastic album.
One album's worth of really good material, yeah.
Exactly. And that had he released that one album, and if he, not obviously that the rest of the band would be very happy, but if he'd released that album under his own name, it would have been an absolute barnstormer. Because the thing is with Tin Machine 2 is that it is incredibly more melodic than Tin Machine 1. And I am baffled about why it got destroyed in the press. Q Magazine, which is the big UK magazine, They ran the headline "Our Tin Machine Crap." That was the front page. That was the front cover thing. I was just like, "What?" So, and it was this weird thing going back to what you said at the beginning about Bowie sort of hiding in the band. Like the press just couldn't deal with that. They couldn't accept it. They couldn't even go, "That's a bit silly, but okay, move on." They just came back to it again and again and again. It's almost like they had nothing else to write about, so they just had to find something else to hang the hook on. And then there's that weird momentum where one newspaper writes a bad review and then it just snowballs into...
Yeah.
There becomes a critical consensus that it's rubbish. So, yeah, that seemed to be what was the death of that. And then, of course, the band imploded because drugs start to get involved with some of the band members, and Bowie was just out of there immediately because, obviously, he's...
As a recovering addict himself, yeah.
Absolutely. He didn't want to be anywhere around it. The other interesting thing with that as well is that between the two albums being released, so Tin Machine 1 was 1989 and Tin Machine 2 was 1991, Bowie went off and did the Sound and Vision Greatest Hits tour. And that literally was the greatest hit. So after the sort of theatrical excess and logistical nightmare of the Glass Spider tour, Bowie is like, right, I'm going to go out. This is basically my retirement fund. I'm going to play all the hits. But he billed it, and I'm still, it just sort of, it's just gobsmackingly audacious. He billed it as, this is the last time I'm going to play any of my hits ever again. This is the last time you'll hear Space Oddity. This is the last time you'll hear Ziggy Stardust. Blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's just...
I remember that, yeah.
It's just like, wow. So, unsurprisingly, it was sold out.
Yeah.
And I mean, I travelled from Plymouth to Milton Keynes Bowl, which... Have you been there?
Milton Keynes Bowl, yes. Yes, I've been there several times, yeah.
As you know, it's not the most salubrious of venues. It's basically...
A field.
Yes, a field. Yes, yeah, so I was there on... I was there on one of the hottest days of the year. You know, people were collapsing left, right and centre. And of course, Bowie came out, and it was just magnificent. Because did you see the tour, Anthony, by the way?
No, I did not, no.
With the Sound of Vision thing, what's very weird is that there is no video or DVD which released the show, which is really surprising because at the time it was incredibly groundbreaking for its use of video. So basically there was this massive video screen behind Bowie, which was, you know, stadium-sized screen. And it had all kinds of really clever... footage that was shot so that Bowie live on stage was kind of interacting with the images behind him. So for example, when he always opened each show with Space Oddity, he would be out there on his own playing the guitar, and then this massive picture of Bowie's head would just come in from the side in profile, and come down, and it would be so positioned, it looked like it was kissing the Bowie on stage and then moving away again. And it obviously sounds a bit like, what? But it really worked. It was quite incredible. I talked to a friend about this, and he reckons the reason they never released it is that it was just impossible to capture that sense of scale and the connection between the performer and the stadium, and the way the two things sort of interconnected, that you just couldn't capture on a DVD. So,
well, and think about the technology of the time as well. Like, you know, yes, you could have lots of cameras sweeping around on cranes and stuff, but we were still in pretty much the early MTV era. You know, it was only the 1990. We're not talking, you know, sort of modern day where you can do anything and have virtual cameras and CG everywhere and overlay stuff with no loss of quality and blah, blah, blah. You couldn't do that then. So I imagine just the filming technology was probably an issue as well.
Yes, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought of that. It's funny that they didn't even release like a, you know, poor version, because think about the track listing. It would basically be Changes Bowie. So it would have sold like hotcakes, even if it was absolute rubbish. It's very weird that never. And the thing is as well, because there is no what would you call it? Like, a document of that tour, unlike Glass Spider, Serious Moonlight, it's kind of disappeared from memory. But for me, when I saw that tour, it's like, you know, it just blew my mind. It was everything I wanted Bowie to be, even though it was the sort of fag end of the sanitized, family friendly, oh, if you like Phil Collins, you might like Bowie kind of era, which is actually typified to me at that gig by. So it's a huge field, and there was a family there. I felt quite sorry for them. They'd actually laid out a picnic blanket on the grass. And of course, when Bowie comes on stage at 9 o'clock, there's just this stampede towards the stage. I mean, you've never seen anything like it. And this poor guy standing there with his picnic blanket going, no, no, we were here first. And like, you know, no one cares at all. And that was kind of the kind of people that were coming to the Bowie gigs at that point. Not of course, that there's anything wrong with having a picnic blanket at a Bowie gig. But my point was, is that he had moved out to such a, wider audience there, that the sets he had to play, obviously had to be quite heavily weighted towards the 80s stuff as well. So Let's Dance, Modern Love, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the sort of the weird Bowie of the 70s had been sort of quietly airbrushed and, you know, made palatable, if you like.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, some people don't see it as Tin Machine as his kind of rebirth, the catalyst for his rebirth, and yet a necessary step for him to go through, because he himself, he went on record saying, and has done many times since, saying that he felt like, as you said, that he was trapped, that he felt like he had to surf. He'd found this massive new audience with the success of stuff like Let's Dance, and he felt that he had to serve them. He felt that he had to make more music that they would like, because he didn't want this success to desert him. But of course, that is, you know, it's so easy to look at in retrospect. That is poison to an artist. Once you start doing that and thinking, oh, I have to do it this way because that's what my current audience wants, you are just going to keep making the same old stuff. You get trapped in a downward spiral. I mean, there are some great bands that don't change so much. You know, famously, the example I always use is Motorhead. But Motorhead didn't not change because that's what their fans demanded. They did it because they were bloody minded and that's what they wanted to do. It wasn't because they didn't have enthusiasm for it. Whereas you could tell by Never Let Me Down, as you say, from the recording sessions alone, but you could tell by the album that Bowie clearly did not have the enthusiasm for that kind of music anymore, because he had indeed got bored. And when that happens as an artist, you either become, I'm not going to name any names, but you become the kind of artist who just turns up and sings the hits and goes away and cashes the check, or you have to go through this period of reinventing yourself. And so many artists have done it, and not all of them succeed. But the good ones, yeah, it's rough. It is rough for a few years, but then they come out of the other side re-energized. And I think it's really, as you absolutely said, with Reeves Gabrel's work especially, it's really interesting to listen to these albums, and especially Tin Machine 2, and in retrospect, look at them and think, wow, this really sounds like what we now think of as a Bowie record. But of course, at the time, that wasn't the case. It's almost like he was using Tin Machine as a kind of incubator to discover his own new sound and use it as a sort of a safe place to experiment and try out this more modern sound.
Absolutely. Well, brilliantly said. Damn it, that's my next 5 minutes gone. yes, because that was my long-winded point of trying to make about the Sound and Vision tour. So I was, you know, I was there, I loved it, I was blown away, a picnic blanket, brilliant. And then everything I've read about Bowie talking about that tour was how much he hated it, how much not wait for it to end. Yeah, so that was quite a, not a slap in the face, but that was just exactly what you just said about the dichotomy and the difference between the performer and the audience is kind of like, so like, you know, Bowie's faithfully signed up, said, okay, we'll do this. Do you remember, like, for Sound and Vision, he actually made it a public poll so that the fans could vote for what songs he'd play, and the NME tried to rig it that he'd have to do the Laughing Gnome,
yeah.
which he said he would have done until he found out that they'd rigged it, so... I'd love to have heard a thrash metal version of Laughing Gnome. So the thing is that what you just said about Tin Machine being the catalyst is that this tour happened in between, and I think it was relatively short. It only took up like maybe 5 or 6 months of his time, and he just could not wait to get back in the studio and get back with the rest of the Tin Machine guys and, well, basically the second album. I think actually it was all probably mixed up, you know what I mean? They had all different sessions, and they didn't just do Tin Machine 1 and then do Tin Machine 2. Anyway, and there was actually going to be a third album. So there was a real momentum going on there. But I think your point about how this Tin Machine now actually defines what we think of as a David Bowie album sounding like, if you like, sort of post-80s, is completely bang on. It's... I mean, when I listened, because I hadn't listened to Tin Machine for yonks until we had this chat about, oh, should we talk about it? And it honestly, it's like, it's aged like fine wine. I mean, the stuff on Tin Machine 2 particularly, it's like, I would defy that you could drop that into any greatest hits collection and you just wouldn't even know it's Tin Machine.
I think you could drop most of those tracks onto any album post-Earthling, anything from Heathen onwards, or Hours onwards even, and you just wouldn't even notice, would you?
Well, I mean, I think, frankly, like Prisoner of Love on Tin Machine 1. Now don't be fooled by fools who promise you the world and all that glitters more fools. Could have fitted that and I Can't Read, which is probably the highlight of that album. Money goes to money heaven. Bodies go to body hell. I just cough and catch the chase. Switch the channel, watch the police car. Both those tracks could have fitted on side two of Scary Monsters. I could have happily lost Kingdom Come and Scream Like a Baby and put those two on there instead. And it's the same kind of dynamic. It's the same kind of, use of melody. The problem is the Tin Machine 1, and I too totally get what it, the criticism always was, there's not much nuance. You get bludgeoned over the head a lot of the time. And that, frankly, is true. And those are all the tracks on there that I don't really care for. They're very one-dimensional. These are tracks like the opener, Heaven's in Here, Crack City. Oh, come, boy, children, don't grab that scabby hand. It belongs to Mr. Sniffletail. It belongs to the candy man. Don't whore your little bodies to the worms of paradise. Like Everest, it's fatal. Its peaks are cold as ice. They're riding on the subways. They're riding on the streets. They'll ride you down to the gutters. They'll ride you off your feet. Gonna hit Crack City. It's sort of, it's not awful, but you don't feel like you're going to get much out of listening to it again. Because the other key problem here is, like, because Bowie was going with the whole, like, first thought, best thought thing, but this is one of the few times he abandoned his cut-up technique of writing lyrics. So you actually have a lot of sort of COD philosophical, social commentary stuff. So Crack City is about taking drugs, you know, crack destroying neighborhoods and blah blah blah. Well, you're obviously all very worthy and important to address, but frankly, not by a pop star in a song, you know, that's going 100 miles an hour. I mean, it's not really saying anything particularly clever. It's not really Bowie's way of dealing with issues. Similarly, like, a lot of the songs are very they're very sexy, as Nigel Tufnell from Spinal Tap was saying. What's wrong with being sexy? But they're sort of overtly sexual, and again, that's quite weird, and it's not what Bowie does. Like, Bowie sort of, you know, basically oozed sex without ever being crude or lavishkous or whatever. Okay, well, maybe some of the Ziggy stuff's a bit rude, but do you know what I mean? He just sort of
this had is that. Where I insert a clip from Time.
Well, I was thinking Sweet Head on Ziggy, but yes, I mean, but yeah, either one. But do you take my point, though? It's kind of like he just had that charisma and gravitas, and it's actually quite weird hearing him singing lyrics like Pretty Thing. That got a lot of criticism. There's one track like Tie You Down, Pretend You're Madonna, which just sounds so tame now. You know, it's like,
right,
but back then it was like, oh my God, you know.
And again, I think this is all part of that important process. He's venting, essentially. He's getting out all the things that he felt like he couldn't, that he felt he wasn't able to do. But clearly, at the back of his mind, there was an urge saying, why not try this? And for all this time, he was like, no, I can't, because the audience that I've found now through Let's Dance won't like it. And this is him clearly getting all that stuff out, and not all of it was good. Some of them were bad ideas.
Yep.
But until you actually get them out and sort of commit them to a form, you don't know if they're a bad idea. I get this all the time with my work, with writing. Like, I have an idea and I think, I can't tell if that's good or bad until I actually write it down. Because while it lives in your head, it's kind of course it's perfect, because things that live in your head are, but then you get them out and you make them into an artistic form and you look at them and you go, oh, actually, that's not so great after all. But you don't know until you've done it. And that combined with, as you say, this commitment to do, you know, first idea, best idea, and indeed first take, best take with Tin Machine, means that we do have to take the rough with the smooth on this album.
Yes, I completely agree. I think the other thing as well that that comes up is that I can't remember which track it's in. Oh, it's Crack City. There is one great liner. It's come on and get a good idea. Come on and get it soon. And there's parallels between what he's talking about on this album, particularly the whole track I Can't Read, which is fantastic because it's him grappling with the fact that maybe he's completely lost it. Maybe he has lost his ability to write great songs anymore. And in the process, he writes a great song. Well done. But that is just exactly the same crisis he went through when he wrote Low. I mean, that's what Sound of Vision's about. So, it's again, lucky old him that he can be so meta and turn his own agony into something there that sort of helps push him forward. And like you say, though, it just seems to be a process to go through. I think the issue I would have is that I completely agree with First Thought, Best Thought. Is that I just wish, like I say, that they just sat on some of these tracks for a while or basically they just didn't have an editor. No one standing around saying, maybe dump that, guys. Because, like I say, some of these tracks, they're just so one-dimensional. It's just kind of like, this isn't really going to get anywhere. And if they had just condensed the two albums into one, then... Because the other thing as well is that on the second Tin Machine album, there's far more melody and there's a beautiful uses of acoustic guitar on there, which frankly is the first time he used the acoustic guitar since Ziggy. I mean, like they managed to mix acoustic guitars and huge, great drums, which is always, always nice. A particular favorite of mine is Amlapura, which is about a particular area of Bali in Indonesia, which Bowie was very smitten with.
Flying Dutchman, smoking gun and spice when I dream of Vanapura.
Him and Iggy Pop would go on holiday there. They've been back there several times, apparently. They're in Java. And he recorded a version of it in Bahasa Indonesian.
Wow.
Yes, which my Indonesian friends are always, that's the first thing I mentioned David Bowie. They're like, oh yeah, he did that track about Amlapura, because of course Amlapura, like if you live in Bali, it's like Reading or something, although a bit more a bit more exciting than Reading. But if you're Balinese, it's a famous place.
Right,
and it's actually on the eastern coast of Bali, which is an area I've spent quite a lot of time as well, because it's great for scuba diving. That track's obviously, I feel connected to it because I actually kind of know where it is and stuff. But it's where he goes back to using cut-up lyrics, and that actually is the same kind of thing that runs through Tin Machine 2. Baby Universal and You Belong and Rock and Roll are just, again, fantastically catchy, melodic songs.
When the child goes bad, it's no cause for celebration. Like Timmy Dean, he don't talk back to me.
And I wonder as well, just to sort of go off on a tangent here, is that that album, Tin Machine 2, I mean, really, it was sort of, it seems to me it was built for American radio. It's not AOR, but it's got enough rough edges knocked off it to be radio friendly.
Sure.
I'd actually say, weirdly, the parallel to it, I think of, is the Sisters of Mercy's Vision thing, which was a blatant stab at moving into America, which failed, sadly, but that's what it was. It was an attempt to harness their sound and vision into something that the American market might find more palatable.
I think by then it was a case of, and the same, I think it's the same reason why Tin Machine 2 got so badly reviewed in the UK press especially, is that they'd poisoned the well. Tin Machine 1 was so odd and so not what people expected from Bowie that they not exactly prejudged Tin Machine 2, but they were like, well, this doesn't sound sufficiently different from Tin Machine 1 for us to change our opinion. Even though to enthusiasts like us, it does sound quite different. And you can see the progression. And it is, as you say, it's more melodic, less bludgeoning over the head. You know, it is much more a sort of polished sound. But unless you approach it with that attitude of like, okay, let's see what this one's like. Let's see how this has changed and what interesting stuff they've come up with for us now. If you instead approach it with like, well, I didn't like Tin Machine 1 very much, so I don't think I'm going to like this, then of course, you know, you're going to just dismiss it. And I think that is a large part of why it got bad reviews and didn't get that American radio play that they were after.
Yes. Also, the cover was a big problem. Did you read about that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So they had to airbrush the genitals out of the statues on the cover. I forget, it's a particular kind of antique statue, isn't it?
They're Greek, I think, aren't they? Greek statues. And yes, they sort of, well, they airbrushed them out, but they also made it look a bit like they might be fig leaves or something. It's very strange.
Yes. Anyway, so that was a bit of a cock up. I think that's the sort of thing, like you say, the bad reviews coupled with a cover that someone like Walmart's going to freak out about. It's like, it back then, because obviously this is all pre-interwebs.
Right, this is the days when Walmart freaking out could actually make a big difference.
Absolutely. And don't forget, it was released on some, and again, this is just so bizarre because it's David Bowie. It's like, it was released on some poxy little record label called Victory, who I think went bust, which is part of the reason why the record's deleted. And I presumably there was some clever financial tax reason or whatever that they went through that label rather than, or EMI just didn't want to touch it. I don't know.
Well, EMI basically dropped the group after the first album. Bowie's right. Said that they just kind of freaked out at its lack of, at what it sounded like and its lack of success. And they were just like, no. Nah.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the other thing is going back to the experimental part of it. I mean, there's a Brian Eno quote that Bowie was very fond of bringing up, which is basically, art is the only time where you can crash an aeroplane and just walk away. And I think that's exactly what he was doing here. And I was actually this morning, I was listening to Tin Machine 2 again, and then because it's on YouTube, it just went straight into Bowie's next like real David Bowie album, laughably called the comeback album, which is Black Tie White Noise. And I listened to the first two or three tracks of that, and I was just, again, I was gobsmacked because it sounds so contemporary now. I mean, it's like very, it's hard to say what it is. It's sort of a weird mix of techno but mixed up with all kind of Middle Eastern influence and stuff like that. And again, I wouldn't be running around sort of going, oh yeah, it's his best thing ever. But I was kind of like, there really is something in here. This is actually really good. And I hated it when it came out. I absolutely hated it. Yeah. So, which is kind of what I was trying to get to, is that I think what he personally always wanted to do, what he loved, was the shock of the new. And
yeah.
I think that's what, and I don't just mean him sort of sitting there rubbing his hands going, oh, this is going to really annoy my audience. I think for him, it was that he had to find the new stuff that just set him off thinking about stuff in different ways.
Well, it goes all the way back to that final Ziggy Stardust performance in London, where he came out on stage for the second half and said, this is the last gig we'll ever play. And, yes. You know, what people, of course, didn't know at the time was what he actually meant was, this is the last gig I'll ever play with Mick Ronson. but it's that same sort of urge of like, I've had enough of this, and so I'm gonna just put a stop to it before I have any second thoughts.
Sure. But I think as well, though, it's this artistic imperative that you had. And I know, so this is the thing as well, is that there's a great book that came out just a couple of months ago. I think it's just called Bowie on Bowie. And it's some very clever guy has compiled a bunch of Bowie interviews from the 60s right through to, well, to his final interview in, I think, 2002, 2003. And reading through that, it is he says several times, because he was an amazing person to interview. He was so enthusiastic and polite and...
Well, and smart.
And smart and clever and funny. And yeah, that video clip has done the rounds of him talking about what the internet's going to do to the music business in... I mean, it's just spot on. It's incredible. Anyway, and several times it comes up in these interviews that he's just kind of like, look, I know I just sound outrageously pretentious, but I don't care because this is the area I want to go into and this is what I've got to find out about. And I remember there was Trent Reznor was talking about Bowie quite recently, like a couple of years ago, because obviously Trent Reznor's still a huge Bowie fan. And he was talking about when The Next Day came out, he was talking about, you know, when we did the outside tour with Bowie, and Bowie was like, okay, you know, I'm going to go on tour with you guys and I'm not going to play many of the hits, I'm going to do the outside material. And Reznor was just like, I just didn't get it. I did not get why he was going to put himself through that. Because obviously he's playing to a Nine Inch Nails audience. They're not turning up to see Bowie. They're turning up to see Nine Inch Nails. And so they had this sort of nightly room clearing effect. You know, like people would just leave as soon as Bowie came on. So, which must be, well, I don't know. I assume that would be heartbreaking. But I assume, again, though, if you're as bloody-minded as Bowie clearly is, clearly up there with Lemmy, also God bless him, that he just didn't care because he needed to be out on that stage doing those songs at that time because that's what interested him. And I've got to love that sort of uncompromising approach. It's just kind of like, I'm going to do this, you know, and that's that because I have no interest in anything else right now. And I think... the thing is there, when we talk about art and music, is that Bowie set the way for a lot of other people where we have this sense of like, you have to trust the artist. You really do. So, for example, I'd say like Nick Cave, I will buy any Nick Cave album without hearing a single note in it because I trust him that it won't be rubbish. Now, I may not like it very much, but I know he would not release a bad or cynical or whatever album, that whatever he's done, he's poured his heart and soul into it.
He wouldn't release something that he's not into.
Precisely. Exactly. He wouldn't release something he didn't believe in. And I think as well with Bowie, that is very much the case. And I think also, because all of Bowie's 90s albums, I hated when they came out. Or it wasn't I hated them, but I just could not understand it. Every time it was like, OMG, WTF, you know, Earthling, all that kind of stuff. I was just like, what is this? And it was the shock of the new every time. And then it took me a couple of years and then suddenly it'd be like, oh, right. You know, it's almost like I caught up to what he was thinking. And as things have splintered in the 90s, obviously the rise of the net, so obviously the way we perceive culture and the way culture functions on us is much more, this huge splintered mess rather than the sort of much more monolithic thing it was in the 70s and 80s pre-net. I think Bowie's impact necessarily got lost in some of that because he's obviously one of so many other people all of a sudden. And obviously he's old, so no one cares. But I still think, though, is that if you are a Bowie fan and you're listening to his albums, then the people he really cares about are the ones that are kind of like, okay, go for it. I just want to know what you're into now and why do you find this exciting and what's interesting? And I'm probably not going to like it much, but it might set me off on something else. He doesn't want an audience that just says, give me the pretty tunes, because he's done that and he's bored of it, you know? And I mean, to be fair, when you come back to Black Star, I mean, a couple of tracks in there are some of the most beautiful things he's ever written. So it is that sense of, I think that's the jump now that other artists have got to start to make, is that, and obviously people say, oh, who's going to be the next Bowie? Of course, I'll never be another Bowie.
No.
But it is that sense of like, we need people that sort of put a stake in the ground and are willing to take on these challenges and take the brickbats of doing so. Yeah, because obviously now we live in a formula age, don't we, where everything's like tested and checked and blah, 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 and, you know, all this work on the market and all that guff. And we've got that dichotomy of anyone can put anything out, but you've got to better find them. And also that person has to be suitably inspired and brave to do something, you know, that is particularly out there.
I agree. And it is why artists like that are so important. And actually, pretty much all of my favorite bands these days are bands that do that, that will change and shift and try new things and, you know, not don't care, but are just kind of like, this is what we're doing. This is, you know, you can either like it or not, but this is what we need to do right now. I think that's really important for artists. And it's funny that you and I have, even though we both love Bowie, we love different parts of Bowie. And for me, actually, those mid-90s albums are some of my favourites of his. Like, Outside is probably my favourite Bowie album overall. And I love Earthling as well.
I salute you.
I loved that he was doing these unusual, strange things that were not like anything he'd done before and that were difficult and sounded odd. And yeah, I loved that somebody as established as Bowie was willing to do that. And I actually kind of lost interest with albums like Heathen and Hours, where I thought he was kind of sliding back into, well, this is kind of what we expect of Bowie. Whereas what I wanted was the unexpected. That's actually one of the reasons I do like Black Star, by the way, because it is not at all what you would expect from Bowie, and especially, you know, a man of his age.
I totally agree. I mean, there's, I don't know if you've seen the blog Pushing Ahead of the Dame, written by Chris O'Leary. I really recommend it. Basically, Mr. O'Leary took on the Herculean task of writing a blog post about every single David Bowie song.
Oh, wow.
Which he has done now. Or he's just writing about Black Star, and of course, now that Bowie's died, that he's sort of coping with that. But he's published a book, came out last year. It's called Rebel Rebel. And that goes up. I can't remember to which point it goes. I think somewhere in the mid-70s. But anyway, there's going to be a sequel. So what happens is that he posts the blogs. There's now a fantastic community around it who comment on the blog posts. And then he polishes it all up, you know, brings in the stuff that people have corrected him on or whatever and suggested. And then that's actually the final version that goes out in the book. So it's fantastic. And he has some incredibly well nuanced points to make as he goes along with Bowie. He says, yeah, like from Heathen onwards, or Hours, I guess, Bowie becomes like his own sort of rock classicist. You know, it's like the classicist phase where he's sort of curating his own back catalogue, and the he calls the Earthling Outside the rave uncle, you know, like that's gone. and you know, but he, so
I like rave uncle.
no, this is the thing. So he's a great writer in the sense that he obviously adores Bowie, but it's not a hagiography, Bowie would never want. And he can be wonderfully sort of sending Bowie up rave uncle. And yet for him, he wrote this quite moving piece about, I don't know, it was one of Bowie's appearances on TV around about the time of Earthling. Of course, do you remember that's when he had like the bright orange hair again, and he's wearing that sort of green silk, you know, and the heavy eyeliner, all that sort of stuff. And he said it was the last time that Bowie actually looked really quite scary and dangerous. And obviously this is going out on, I don't know, Johnny Carson or something. You know, it is really quite odd. And it's that thing of remembering this was this guy that was such a huge star and could just had sort of a gateway into all this mainstream stuff that, again, pre-internet, you know, was a big deal. And yet, like you say, he could put out these incredibly weird albums and turn up looking like a complete nutter. I mean, it's fantastic. How could you how could you not love it? How could you not love
exactly.
it? Exactly. I'd actually say with Tin Machine, that is actually one of the other big problems that they had, is that it's the most masculine, it's like hyper-masculine that Bowie's ever appeared. He had a beard for a start, you know, which is, given how handsome he is, not a good idea. But yeah, it was wearing leather jackets, and on the second album there anyway, and like I was saying before, like some of the songs are very sexy. It was just kind of like, where is the sort of, well, the weird Bowie, the gay Bowie, you know, the Bowie that was basically the sexual adventurer, as someone called him in one of the obituaries.
Where's the sass?
Yeah, where's the sass? Exactly. I mean, where, you know, because again, it's that thing of like, you think about, you say weird Bowie, because it's like, you're not sure if he's a boy or a girl. And it's like, he doesn't threaten you. He doesn't mean you any harm, but he's certainly making you question about how you feel about him, because maybe you're a boy and you're turned on by him, and maybe, you know, or maybe you want to beat him up or whatever, blah, blah, blah. All those things that he provoked in the 70s is kind of like, and he could frankly still do it, you know, even being rave uncle or whatever. I mean, he's still an incredibly good looking guy at 50 or whatever. And Tin Machine, though, was almost like he was trying to hide all of that as well. And I don't know, maybe for him, it was just kind of like he was just sick of having to come up with a particular persona or something. I don't know, but I think...
Well, I think there's an aspect, you get this with a lot of the artists who go through this, there's an aspect of, I've done that as much as I can. I've taken that as far as it will go. And now I have to kind of deliberately suppress that and try something else to see if it works and see if I can take anything valuable from it.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, I want to end with a nice memory. So I know, because you and I used to work together in the .NET offices, that you and then editor Rich Longhurst flew to New York for a weekend to see Bowie perform at Madison Square Garden, which at the time, and even now, still kind of blows my mind that you went to New York for what? Well, you were there for what, 2.5 days? Just to see Bowie and then flew back again.
It wasn't Rich. It was my friend Jake, actually. But
I thought it was you and Rich.
No. Well, this is actually a story I wanted to tell you. So this is a nice point to end it on. So we're talking at the beginning about Tin Machine was my first album. I was 17. But actually, Bowie for me has been the thread that's run through my whole life, because obviously I've been into his music since I was 15, and I met a guy called Jake when I was 16. Who has become one of my oldest and longest friends and closest friends still. And even though, like, I'm living the other side of the world from him, like, we're still in regular contact. But it was Jake who got me the ticket to see Bowie in New York, because Jake was a member of the Bowie fan club, and Bowie played at Roseland Ballroom just for the fans. So it was like a 2000 capacity venue.
My memory of this is completely and utterly wrong then. I've mythologized the whole thing.
But the reality was even better, because Madison Square Garden's an absolute aircraft hangar of a place, isn't it?
Whereas true.
Roseland's like London Astoria. So that was actually for my 30th birthday.
Actually, no, hang on. It can't have been your 30th birthday, can it?
Oh, it can. Hang on. When was I 30?
13 years ago. Well, 13 years ago was 2002.
That's right. So, yes, yeah, so when, yep, when it, maybe you're thinking of, we saw Bowie. Rich and I saw Bowie at the London Astoria in 1999. Maybe you're thinking of that.
Oh, maybe I've got the two right. So I've got the two things
confused,
completely conflated. My memory was playing tricks on me, but at least now I know why. I'd conflated the two events. I hadn't just made stuff up out of whole cloth.
Yeah, so that's the other thing for me. So just thinking, just to close on this, is that I was thinking about how much like Bowie is baked into my life, basically. I mean, I'm 43 now. So baked into my life, he's just there. And of course, this is part of just being old now, you know, and that's fine. I mean, I love it. I mean, I would not want any other pop star in my life that long. Actually, Leonard Cohen, he's up there as well. Brilliant, well done. But it makes me think about how the importance of him, not as a pop star, but as like a cultural lodestone, a thing, again, pre-internet, how, you know, he kind of, this is a trope, is that he was the internet. He was this beacon of like, here's all these different things you should check out that you've probably never heard of before. So he was sort of pointing the way. He was like a human Wikipedia. So it's like, yeah, check out that Japanese clothes and so on and so forth. And that has been huge in terms of like my friendship with Jake, is that it sort of led us into so many different conversations, and obviously not just about Bowie, but about the whole gamut of culture and art and what is art and blah 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 blah. It's massively stimulating, and he is like the instigator of a lot of that, and that's the thing that's really weird with Black Star, is that it's, for me, this week's actually been really difficult, because it's a weird echo of my father's death, because he died 6 months ago. And he was the same age as Bowie, and he died of cancer as well. And all this week, I've been thinking about my father and thinking about the songs on Black Star and thinking, Jesus, this is probably what my dad was thinking about as well. I mean, particularly when you listen to Lazarus, mm-hmm. and Dollar Days. They are just quite remarkable lyrics, and for a man facing his own death to be able to do that, and presumably to be talking to his family and, you know, trying to really keep it together before he goes and leave that as a final statement. I mean, it's just absolutely fantastic. But I also think it's an articulation of, those of us who are not lucky enough to be able to create like that, it's an articulation of our own lives. And if we're facing death or illness, is that it's a way of thinking, you know, you can be free. You can have a dignified exit. There is a way out of this. You know, it doesn't have to all be darkness and misery.
What a beautiful thought. All right, Chris, thanks ever so much for coming on and talking to me about this. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
They can find me on Twitter at Travel Happy. Basically, right now, I'm in pretty much read-only mode on Twitter, but you'll find a whole bunch of David Bowie retweets.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned, and please remember to check out my comics, books and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com for information and links to all of my work. You can support the show by rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes, and if you really like it, please leave a review. It's the best way to spread the word to new listeners. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find information, links and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I was going to bring up age because you mentioned it very early on when we were talking. When Bowie started to, you know, when Tin Machine formed, Bowie was 41.
Holy f***.
Right. Yeah, I know. But I know that you're the same age as me. And it's when I realized that I suppose it was in the back of my mind, but when I actually looked it up and I said, oh yeah, he just passed 40. Suddenly so many things click into place. So many things make sense, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing I meant to say in the intro is that I think Tin Machine was his 17th album, 17th or 18th. I mean, it's insane. I mean, I can't think of anyone else who's had that kind of output and stayed relatively good apart from Leonard Cohen, Miles Davis and Prince. That's it. I can't think of anyone else who's managed to, and you know, even Prince, again, severely in need of a good editor. But
I actually just looked it up. It was his 18th. Never Let Me Down was his 17th album.
Good.
17th
grief.
Studio album, yeah. So, yeah, 18 albums, and he decides to reinvent himself at the age of 41. What are we doing with our lives?
Well, yeah, exactly. There's that meme, isn't it? That thing going around saying, oh, you know, if you want to really depress yourself, just look at what
David Bowie has accomplished by your age. What was David Bowie doing at your age? Yeah.
I'm very fond of Heathen. I this is the funny thing with Bowie is that I very rarely listen to one of his albums from start to finish. I think, again, Black Star is incredible because it is this piece of work that he conceived to be listened to from beginning to end, and it works perfectly. But so for me, for example, I would happily take like side one of Low and add it to side one of Scary Monsters, and that would kind of probably be my Desert Island Disc album, something like that.
Ah, right. I'm completely the opposite. I'm very much, especially with Bowie, not with all artists, but with Bowie is one of the artists where if I want to listen to Bowie, I will just, you know, press play on an album and listen to the whole thing.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just sort of, I don't know, a bit picky.
Perish the thought.
Me? Picky? Picky how? In what
don't
way
you know
am I picky?
I am? I'm Chris Mitchell.
I think it's in that book of interviews I mentioned. So obviously Bowie and Eno are together again for Outside. One Outside.
Yes.
So annoying.
Well, you know why that was?
Because there's going to be contamination afterwards, yeah.
That's right, contamination. It was going to be a cycle, and it was going to end at the millennium with number 5 inside, I think was the original plan.
I haven't listened to it yet, but there's a whole, on YouTube, there's a whole thing called the Leon Suite, which is apparently the outtakes of contamination.
Apparently. Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, yeah, seek that out.
You
yeah.
should hunt that down. Yeah, and Chris O'Leary talks about this on his blog, so you should definitely go and check that out as well. I think you'll like it.
So anyway, sorry, you were saying about Eno.
So obviously you talk about it saying, okay, so you know Eno loves to do his like oblique strategies and stuff to
get
musicians doing different stuff. And he said, he's saying, yeah, Bo is saying, yeah, so Brian got out the oblique strategies because the problem is musicians, if you tell them to jam, is that every single time they just end up jamming the blues. That's what they always go back to, it's the blues. Yeah, and so we force them to do all sorts of mad stuff. But Tin Machine is Bowie doing the blues. I mean, those two albums are the most blues-based thing he ever did. So it's it is kind of funny, again, that five years previous, from outside, he's kind of doing the blues, and it's kind of like, okay, he's done that, and it's kicked out of his system. It's all finished with, sort of thing. But I do think, when you listen particularly to Tin Machine 2, it is the nearest to Ziggy in terms of, I don't know, rhythm, melody. I'm not a musician. You know better than I do. In terms of like just straight ahead, pretty songs, you know, with a rock and roll beat, two drums, a bass, drums, two guitars, and the acoustic guitars particularly. I mean, it is the most straightforward Bowie ever was again after Ziggy. I'm really sorry, mate. I've lost my thread. What was it you just said about? Oh, yeah, so it's about Heathen. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. So, and he